No, I know this chick.
All right. This is Edris Wise on January the 4th, 1985, speaking to Joseph Poyce for National Council of Jewish Women's Oral History 2. This is side 7. Dr. Poyce, we were at the end of our last tape talking about your time with Temple Sinai.
Well, a lot happened. And of course, please don't get this was some years ago, so in fairness to these institutions.
It's all part of history.
Yeah, it's all part of history. So I received a letter saying the membership committee wanted to interview me, and then would I please bring along at least one half of the membership fee? I was so rebuffed and so disgusted with the thing. For the very bottom, I said, the hell with it. And I said, this is a strange way. You go to the service, and in the Jewish service, and there was a it says how you should welcome a stranger in your midst. If anything, what you should do is go out of your way. I mean, that's the import of that. And so it was our introduction to Pittsburgh was not a very satisfactory one. And the Jewish community, well, first of all, we found it quite different. And I found that even subsequently, even though when I became a member of the board of B'nai Israel, that unlike Chicago, and by the way, the differences are very great. Chicago, you see, the Jews, you have a Jewish community in Hyde Park, well, of course, now they've moved with most of them, although they still try to keep up some of it because of the racial mix-up. But you have the Jews on the north side, the northwest side. Here, of course, you have a strong, at least when we came here, a strong group here in Squirrel Hill. So the Jewish community is somewhat different. And we found that the Jewish community is a much more closely knit community. See, for example, Chicago, I had no problem. I was well accepted, well accepted in the total civic community, in the total community, and no problem at all if I wanted it in the Jewish community. But, and of course, here, Pittsburgh unquestionably is changing. I haven't studied too much.
Pittsburgh is also a lot smaller than Chicago.
Yes, that's right, and very closely knit. You see, the power structure here. And although I ultimately was on the budget committee of the, Jewish organization here, the
Federation,
and then I was on the Jewish Community Relations Committee, and then on the anniversary, let's see, when was it, the 1978, the 30th anniversary of the founding of Israel, I was the co-chairman. The only reason I survived as co-chairman, I know whether you know this, a very active woman, what's her name, Mrs. Halpern?
Bernard Halpern?
No, not Bernard, there's a name.
Ethel Halpern?
Whose husband is a physician.
Ethel.
Is that? Well, anyhow, she was one so active, she knew everybody. I didn't. But anyhow, I found that Pittsburgh is much more difficult, and of course, that didn't make too much of a difference to me because I didn't aspire to be any sort of leader in the Jewish community. But my wife had a great deal of difficulty adjusting. She joined, but you know, joining organizations doesn't mean anything unless you participate. So she was a member of the council, I guess. She was a member of Hadassah and all those organizations. But somehow, for a person of her type of personality makeup, and I wouldn't want to generalize, other people probably could move in. It just didn't work out, and I know I've discussed this with both my sons. For they didn't like Pittsburgh, but of course, after all, my son, particularly my oldest son, has had very little to do with Pittsburgh. Because he went on to he took his graduate work at the University of Wisconsin and then went from there to the University of Colorado. So
how old were they when they moved here?
Let's see, we moved in 61, and Bob had been born in 1940, so he was 21, and the other one was 18, let's say, because one had just finished high school.
Before we get too much farther,
okay.
You refer to the temple in Chicago as KAM. What do those initials stand for?
Well, I don't want you to ask me how this, but Kiriath Anshemayrav, which in Hebrew is Men of the West, was the first temple of it. first year was Shula was founded there. And initially, I think there was a little landmark indication down at someplace in the center of the city, and they called themselves Men of the West, Kehillas, Anshe, and Myra.
And before we leave Chicago completely, I have two questions I wanted to ask. One of them would be a description of Sergeant Shriver, since he indirectly became very famous because of his brother-in-law, President Kennedy.
Well, interesting enough, I was discussing that with Mrs. Bergman just a few days ago. I asked her to go out to lunch with me, by the way, and then she told me that her husband had participated in this oral history business. Sergeant Shriver was very bright, as you know, again, a very photogenic individual. He had quite a war record. I think he'd been a submarine officer in World War II. And then he had married into the Kennedy family. It was quite obvious that the Kennedy family had certain things in mind for Sergeant Shriver. So he came to Chicago. There's this big merchandise mart in Chicago. That's a tremendous structure which is owned by the Kennedy family. And Mrs. Shriver was made assistant general manager of the merchandise mart. You know, the Jews would say, "Do you mean assistant general manager?" "So do I mean assistant general manager." I think you want to use the Jewish way anyway. And it's quite obvious that the general manager, you know, there's another Jewish expression, neither whether they say a mocking cup.
Right.
But the point was, okay, he was put in as the assistant general manager of merchandise mart, and the mayor then put him on the board of education because after the theory was tied in with the Kennedys, and he ultimately became president. And really was a full-time president because he could devote all of his time to it and was very, extremely, extremely active. And my feeling was, and as I sized him up and saw his actions, that what the Kennedy family had in mind was that he would then be primed to be a gubernatorial candidate in Illinois. But by the way, that was ultimately precluded because the time for his becoming the gubernatorial candidate occurred just when his brother-in-law was running for the presidency. You couldn't have him running for the governorship and his brother-in-law running for the presidency. He was certainly an able man, but it was quite obvious that on decision-making, that this decision-making was very much influenced by his aspirations for the governorship. And I still remember this incident. When I was first appointed, he called me and said, "Why don't we have a talk at the, come down to the merchandise mart for luncheon?" And I came down, he said, "Look, one important aspect of the Board of Education is financial operations. I'm not too satisfied with our finance committee, and I think I would like to have you become chairman of it, you know, after a certain time interval." So I said, "Well, it sounded interesting." And then I attended my first meeting of the full board. And as so happens, I think even the Pittsburgh board does that. The big thing a Board of Education does is award contracts. And of course, Chicago contracts are real, real, real big stuff. And we had so I looked down at the first thing, and one of the big item then was to award a contract for typewriters in the Chicago public schools. Now you can imagine with a business school, you know, schools that gave business courses as well as typewriters for the, you know, for the offices and even the other schools. I mean, an awfully big contract, a lot. And I noticed the prices were all the same. The bids, they showed you the competitive bids. So the thought occurred to me, in working with Signo, that I had some acquaintance with antitrust matters, this business of law prohibiting collusion in connection with interstate commerce. So I raised the question. I said, "Mr. President, don't you think it'd be a good practice of the board whenever we have identical bids of any significance, that we refer it to the United States Attorney to see whether there's been any violation of the law. Well, he was stunned, the rest of the board was stunned, and they passed it. They said, okay, we agree on that. Under the practice of it, we'll not refer this to the United States Attorney. Well, the newspapers then came out with laudatory comments. Here a new member comes in, and I really got, and by the way, the newspapers, they always gave me good press, not the Chicago Tribune, under the Kremlin, but the Chicago Daily News and Chicago Sun-Times, always gave me a fine press. Well, I never got the chairmanship of the board because it was quite obvious Simon Shriver was not going to, not that I was thinking running for governor, but it was that he had to be the president.
He was a threat immediately.
He was a very bright, by the way, but a very bright fellow, very bright.
Well, how would something like that happen? I mean, somebody had to be telling somebody, right?
Yeah.
With all the prices, these were the bids coming in.
But sure, there was collusion.
When you made reference to the alliance between Mayor Richard Daley and the Kennedys, could you explain that a bit?
Well, I felt that there was close understanding that, after all, Joe Kennedy had come into Chicago, this merchandise mart, which is it's a vast establishment on the riverfront there. It's one of the big structures. And it was quite obvious that Joe Kennedy, and the very fact that his son-in-law was coming in, that Joe Kennedy was interested in Chicago. And undoubtedly...
The Kennedys did not live in Chicago.
No. And undoubtedly, I assume that there were conversations. And don't forget that when Kennedy was elected president, it was Illinois in Chicago. I will not say anything further, but... But in fairness to Mr. Shriver, no question about the man. Being quick, being articulate, and being very good and having a great public presence, and certainly as the president of the board, being most conscientious. But I had no reason to defer to him, and because I enjoyed crossing swords, particularly with somebody who's intelligent.
Obvious that something had to have been done about that.
And the same way, when matters with the unions came up, obviously he had to play the game as to not to antagonize. See, we had two union representatives on the Board of Education, one from the CIO and one from the AFL, and it's quite obvious, whereas I could speak up independently. And as I said, I wasn't unacceptable to them, and as I said, the teacher union was most friendly with me.
Were his children in public school?
I'm trying to think whether they were old enough. That I don't. No, I don't think that children are old enough to go to the...
The other thing that you referred to in passing, we didn't have any explanation of, is that you were involved with the Immigrant Service League.
Yeah, that's right.
In what capacity? And explain.
Well, I was on the very, very, very active in it. By the way, as I was leaving the Immigrant Service League, I happened to find this I was on it. How I got on it, I don't know originally, but because my own parents being immigrants, and I've always had a feeling that immigrants, and this Immigrant Service League was concerned with helping particularly people who wanted to bring over individuals from Europe. And a lot of the clientele happened to be Greeks. You know, the Greeks live in the native land. So many of them are so impoverished that when one comes over, he tries then to bring the rest. And we very frequently had problems complying with the immigration laws. And so this organization was set up, and I ultimately became the president of it. And it was just that I happened to pick this. This was the last meeting at which I presided, and then which they passed a resolution accepting my resignation. And telling them they wish me happiness and success in my new post, and congratulate them, and congratulate the University of Pittsburgh, benefited greatly, et cetera, et cetera. I found it a very interesting assignment. I liked it, and because, again, there were some legal aspects involved. Let me
go ahead. You're right ahead.
And I'm going to get to it. I tried to discourage my housekeeper from getting here too early today. She usually doesn't get here very early anyhow. Hello? 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 But, I liked it very much, and I met with some of the, for example, the Chinese. We didn't have too much come to think of it. But the Jewish group, because the Jewish organizations, you see, would take care of what they have, Hebrew Immigrants Aid Society or something. I think the Jews, so we didn't have too many Jews who were. But I particularly, somebody who inspired me, and it was a Mrs. Louie Cohn, K-O-H-N. She was one of the great women Jewish leaders in Chicago. And I suppose if you wanted to say there could be a counterpart, but I don't think you, with due respect to Mrs. Reidenstein, she didn't quite come up to the, she's a very great woman, but in terms of stature, this Mrs. Cohn was a great, great woman. And she was very active in the Immigrant Service League, and she and I developed a very good rapport. And she was something of an inspiration to me, and I just loved working for her. She was a great woman.
Now that brings us up to your move to Pittsburgh.
Okay, all right.
Gail, do you have a question? Sorry, and we are involved with the University of Pittsburgh.
Right. Okay.
From 1961. And at the same time you were at the University of Pittsburgh, you also in 1965 were with AID, which is?
The Agency for International Development, just still be a reference to it. That was 65. That was a special study we made in Central America. A couple of colleagues and myself. Well, let me see. That might be. Fine. I think this is a nature. I don't know.
You want to stop here?
No, I don't know. I think we could go ahead because I don't think this thing would be a sensor.
Good morning.
Did you ring the bell?
Okay. No,
come on. Okay. Sorry I woke you up this early.
That's okay. That's
but I blame it on these women who are coming. I call them. But the AID was eight. In fact, you'll hear reference to it on even right now, AID, when they say about helping in Ethiopia. It's the Agency for International Development, which was set up by the federal government in order to extend assistance to foreign countries. And that was not a tremendous assignment. Two colleagues and I went down to Central America, except I did get a picture of some of the conditions in Central America, to see what could be done to strengthen the teaching in governmental administration in the Central American countries. So we went to countries like Salvador, Costa Rica, and so that's what it was.
Well, what are your impressions? Because at this time, several of those countries are communist, and what we read in the press is there is terrific corruption in the government.
Right. Well, the feeling you have there, and of course some of it is superficial, because after all I didn't make any detailed study, but you do have the impression that people, but I years ago even traveled down to Costa Rica with my wife and had spoken. Now Costa Rica, by the way, is considered the outstanding country in that particular area in terms of democracy and whatnot. But generally, in some of these other countries, you take Salvador, I know I came to the impression of exploitation of, Guatemala, what they've done to the Indians is disgraceful. And you see these impoverished people, and you realize what you have is your wealth at the top and most of the other people being exploited and having a horrible... I came away in fact, I don't care to travel generally. Later on, when speak to my wife and I did take trips to the Caribbean area. This disparity between wealth and these people who are impoverished is always worrying me, and I can understand the people themselves. I'm not saying which side I take, but I can understand why in desperation. Let me put it this way. You can talk about political philosophy, but if a person has an empty stomach, they want some food. And there's no use engaging in political philosophy as to what they believe in. If they're damn hungry.
Right.
And I still remember Guatemala City. I sit in the hotel there, and I looked out, and there was the restaurant had a picture window, and there was an Indian sitting there, just on the sidewalk, just looked right in me, and I just couldn't eat. And I thought, God, after all, I'm eating here. This fellow probably hasn't had a meal for some time. And this wasn't rare, because in a place like Guatemala, they just kill the Indians. It's ruthless. In many cases, you have this question of corruption. By the way, you have that in many countries. It's not only Central America. When we talk about other countries in the world, that this question of governmental corruption, and you talk about the third world, you see, the concept of integrity in government is something that we still have to contend with. And it's a question that always arises in my mind when I consider government, what is the degree of integrity. But you've been asked about Central America, and that's certainly what I saw of Salvador and some of the other countries. I'm trying to think of some of the other. We went to Panama, and I still remember the incident in Salvador. We were supposed to have, there were three of us from the University of Pittsburgh. We were supposed to have an interview with the chancellor of the university, or the rector, as they call them, the university. And it had been arranged through the embassy, the deputy chief of mission, and an embassy is a second-ranking officer. Usually he's a career officer. Sometimes, as perhaps you can read in the newspaper, some of our ambassadors, particularly countries like that, get to be chosen on a political basis. And I remember the ambassador then asked that we come in to see him. We went in to see the ambassador, and he was some political hack. He had been a police court judge in Mexico, Arizona, knew Spanish, that was his only qualification. He said, I understand you gentlemen have an appointment with the rector of the university. We said, yes. He wanted to know why. He said, we were studying instruction public administration. He said, I don't think you better see him, he's a communist. And we said, but what difference does that make? We have an appointment with him. We said we'd like to go ahead without knowing that the appointment was canceled.
He canceled the appointment on his
own. Yeah. Well, I mean, that gives you. In other words, our handling of the Central American situation, I would say, generally, has nothing would happen. It hasn't been a brilliant thing.
Would you like to stop here?
Well, if you want to go ahead, whatever you want to do.
All right, because at this point, I think I'd like to get more involved with Pittsburgh and University and other.
Okay, fine. Well, but if you want to go ahead, at least start just giving me the pitch that's so exciting. If you let me know what you want to be asking, that might help.
Well, I'd like to ask you about, since we are involved with the Department of International Affairs and Public Administration, and there has been a write-up in the newspaper about it, I'd like to hear about your feelings of the controversy and what it's all about.
Well,
what's going to happen?
Well, I suppose you have a problem that this school, my friend Donald C. Stone, who was the founding dean, and it was one who brought me here, he had a certain pattern of the as to how he wanted to set up the school. I can't say I agree completely with the pattern, and I still myself had some questions about it. I felt, because what had happened, the faculty, and I don't want to go into get bore you with all the details, Upland became divided. They had three deans. They had Stone, They had Stone, who was the founding dean. He then had to retire because of age. They then brought in a Dean Howard, who was ultimately dismissed, because ordinarily you don't do that at university, but he refused to resign, so he was dismissed. Then they brought in David Kurtzman. I don't know whether he's he must be in, David Kurtzman as acting dean. Kurtzman had been the chancellor of the university, but because his area was public affairs, they brought him as acting dean. I then became the acting associate dean. And Kurtzman couldn't stay only for a year. Then they brought in a dean called Fenari, and I served as associate dean under him for 1 year with the understanding, because of the age factor, that, you know, I'd be bowing out at the end of one year. With Fenari coming in, a lot of the dissension, which had been welling up in the school, came to a head, and you had a faculty which was split, pro-Fenari, anti-Fenari, and then meetings, faculty meetings, became very divisive. So they made themselves very vulnerable.
This was policy dissension as to the way the structure of the school, and also
what their role should be as the faculty. You see, in universities now, you have a problem, what they call faculty governance. To what extent is the faculty supposed to participate in basic decision making? That gets to be quite an issue in many universities. If I'm the dean, if you're the president of the university, to what extent do you take action? To what extent do you consult? Then it's a question, suppose you consult and then you go ahead and do what you think is sound, and then the question, should you do something which the faculty opposes? And the big issue that came up at Kispia was this question of participation of the faculty. And you had two factions, one that seemed to go with Fenari, the dean, and the other was opposed, and tremendous dissension. When you have dissension in any organization, it makes you very vulnerable if people on the outside start raising questions. And so I can understand that now we're looking over the school, and in fairness to the provost, this new provost, that he's looking over the whole university. He's trying to see what are the elements of strength, what are the elements of weakness, and in allocating the resources of the university, what priorities should you have? Should medicine get more funds? Should the Department of Economics get more money? What about the school such as ours? What does it cost to run the school?
Your school is a graduate.
I was going to say completely graduate. It just gives master's degrees and PhDs.
Always. It always has.
It always has. Which makes it a rather expensive school. Some other departments would have big lecture halls. See, if a professor lectures to 200 students, then maybe has some assistants to help later on in discussion. Your cost per student is rather small. In our case, let's say if I have a class of 20 or 30, or sometimes less, maybe 8, 10, the unit cost gets to be very high. That immediately focuses attention on you. So that, I think in fairness to the provost, Father Stone, I might say, has consulted me, and he wrote extensive memoranda to the provost. Stone, by the way, is now over in Carnegie Mellon University. By the way, so goddamn close that he always felt free to, you know, to call me to come over to read all his material. You do have a problem. Now, there is one thing about the situation about the school. It is known throughout the world. Why? Because we get many foreign students. Many of our foreign students, perhaps some of them haven't taken necessarily degrees, but they take special courses that they offer. And as a result, throughout the world, you know, you can travel throughout the world, whether you go to this country, another country, you can find graduates of GISPI, so it has, as they call